Good afternoon and welcome to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg and we're live for an hour each weekday afternoon. As you know, if you listen regularly, hey, this is a program where you can call in if you have questions you'd like to discuss on the air about the Bible or the Christian faith, or if you've heard a point of view from the host that you don't think is correct and you want to discuss that, feel free to do that. We welcome you. We have lines open right now for you if you want to call. The number is 844-484-5737. That's 844-484-5737. Now, I've been saying for a while that we have an itinerary. We're setting up my year's itinerary of traveling and speaking, and it's really filled in. We've got probably most of the dates booked in these areas I'm going to, but in some cases I can extend my visit if we have more people wanting me to speak, or we might even already have a gap here or there in one of the itineraries. But let me just real quickly run through the places I'm going to be in the next several months. And if you live in one of those areas, one of those states, and you want to set up some kind of a speaking engagement for me, remember, these cost nothing. You just have to have a place, and we will announce on the air, and that's usually all that's necessary. Real quickly, in March, I'm going to be at least a week in Tennessee. By the end of that month, I'll be spending close to a week or about that in Arizona. Then in the following month, I will be speaking in Texas, several different areas. A little later, in May, I'll be in the Seattle area for more than a week. I will then be in August in Michigan. At this point, we just have one thing that I was invited to do in Michigan, so we're putting it on the calendar. And if you live in Michigan, or maybe even Indiana, or somewhere in that general part of the country, we might just be willing to set up meetings around wherever you want to set them up. Just get in touch with us. And then I'll be in Oregon in October. So we've got, about seven different states in fewer months than that. Actually, just a few times, probably about 5 months, we've got seven states. So if you live in any of those areas and you're curious about setting up a meeting for me to speak, feel free to get in touch with us, and we'll be glad to try to work that out. You can see where those meetings are by going to the website, thenarrowpath.com, and looking under the tab that says Announcements. The meetings we already have set up are generally posted there. And then I also want to say this is Friday, so I only have one more chance to tell you that tomorrow is the once-in-a-month opportunity. If you're in Southern California, to attend one of two gatherings we have monthly. One of them is a men's Bible study in the morning in Temecula, and one is just a general Bible study gathering in Buena Park in the evening. And we'll be looking at the books of 2 Peter and Jude there. And so that's all I need to announce, and we'll go to the phones at this point. We have at least one line still open if you would like to join us. You can call this number, 844-484-5737. Our first caller today is Peter, calling from the United Kingdom. Hi, Peter. Welcome.
Hi, Steve. Thanks for taking my call. Steve, are you familiar with the late minister, Carlton Pearson, at all?
I am not. Was he a British or American, or where was he from?
He's American. He was a student of, Oral Roberts was his mentor. But in any case, so I was watching, he featured on Netflix, there's a biography done on him on Netflix. And what was interesting, he held the traditional view of hell. And then later on in his life, he then started teaching what he called the gospel of inclusion, which is essentially similar to the restorationalism view. So now the church essentially how he was received when he changed his view was the church branded him as a heretic. And I know, and I think Origen also subscribed to that universal reconciliation view and was ostracized by the church. So I think my question is, knowing that that's essentially a view of hell, of hell, which there are scriptures that you can use to back it, is it right? Was it right, really? Is it right for the church? Are you actually a heretic, or is it right? Was it right for the church to brand, you know, someone a heretic because they hold that view?
Well, you know, Origen did hold that view, the view that all people will eventually be saved, although some will be in hell first, and through hell they will be brought to repentance so that ultimately all will be saved, is what he taught. And it is true that the Roman Catholic Church, some centuries after his death, did brand him a heretic, not just for that view, but he had other views they didn't like also, and he had some views I don't like. He definitely held non-mainstream views on a number of things. However, he was never branded as a heretic in his lifetime. In fact, in his lifetime, he was probably the most influential theologian on the planet in the churches. He was not necessarily agreed with by everybody, but no one branded him a heretic. And like I said, he was one of the most respected theologians of his day. It was at least a couple centuries after his death that the Catholic Church decided to brand him a heretic, which really it was a pretty good record for him because, you know, Luther and Huss were branded as heretics while they're still alive. So, you know, it took a couple centuries after Origen's death for the Catholic Church to decide to call him a heretic. The fact that the Catholic Church calls somebody a heretic, of course, doesn't tell me anything about whether their views are correct or not. I'm sure the Catholic Church would call many people heretics that I also would regard as heretics, but they also called some people heretics that I don't think deserve that label. Now, should a person be called a heretic if he holds a different view of hell than the traditional view? Well, I'm not sure why. Why would he be? I mean, how is holding a different view of hell problematic? The gospel is not about hell. The gospel is about Jesus. There is a hell. And I think almost all Christians who've ever lived believe there's some kind of a hell. But Christians have not always agreed. In fact, for the first 300 or 400 years, there was no agreement at all as to what hell is. What we call the traditional view of hell, which was taught by Tertullian and some others in the early church, and then was made normal, it was normalized by Augustine in the 4th century. That view was one view that some Christians held before Augustine's time, but many did not. There were people who held Origen's views, probably a great number since he was such an influential theologian. And then there were those who held the view that Irenaeus held. And Irenaeus, of course, was a disciple of Polycarp, who was a disciple of John, and he was very respected. And he held what we'd call the conditional election, conditional immortality view. And that would be what many people call annihilation. So there were three different views of hell that were none of them considered heretical for the first 4 centuries or more, because even Augustine, whose influence normalized the eternal conscious torment view of hell and elevated it from just one of the three views out there to, you know, the mainstream view of the Western Church, even he didn't call it a heresy. He didn't call Origen a heretic. He said that Origen's followers who on this subject were, I think he called them tender-hearted brethren. You know, they were brothers who he felt were a little too sentimental. But he didn't say they were heretics. In fact, he said that they did not disregard Scripture or the Christian faith. So he didn't see them as outside the fold. He just didn't agree with them. So, you know, up even through Augustine's time, no one was held to be a heretic because of their views of hell, even though three different views were known to exist. It was simply not a matter that anyone thought was a core issue of the gospel. And I think they were right in that. It's not. So, yeah, to call somebody a heretic because he holds a different view than the traditional view of hell is simply to be, I would say, theologically provincial. There have always been some Eastern Church fathers, even after Augustine normalized what we call the traditional view of hell in the West, there were still Eastern fathers who were strictly universalist or held some other view of hell. So that was, you know, that was the case. Now, we live in America, or you live in England, but we live in the West, let's put it that way. And the West, Western Christianity has been influenced by two major streams. One is the Roman Catholic, and more recently, the Protestant churches. And both were followers of Augustine in many respects. And so what Augustine believed about hell has been considered by Western Christians to be pretty much normal. But many times people don't realize that it was by no means a universally held view of hell well past Augustine's time. So, to call someone a heretic because they hold a view that a very large portion of the Orthodox Church held, but which isn't as popular in our branch of the Christian faith at this time in history, is to be overly confident in one's own opinions, I would say.
Yeah, I think the concern with it is how it's received. That if you tell someone that you know, if you don't repent in this lifetime, that you'll be ultimately reconciled to God, would then encourage a lifestyle that is ungodly. But then that's probably the basis that they never really were taught about what true discipleship anyway. It's interesting to know that there were actually true Christians that held that view.
If somebody thinks that, you know, given some other view of hell than the traditional view removes reasons for living a holy life, you're right. That person doesn't know what the gospel is. They think the gospel is just a get out of jail free card. And they don't realize that the gospel is about following Jesus and loving God and having a relationship with God that places him at the center of your life. Now, nobody who loves Jesus will go out and live a sinful life. Jesus said, if you love me, you'll keep my commandments, you know? So if someone doesn't love Jesus, they might be pressured into saying they are a Christian because they don't want to go to hell, and therefore the view of hell that is held by those who preach to them may have an influence in getting them to buckle and give up their resistance and to say under duress some kind of a prayer. But that doesn't mean that in any sense their hearts have changed. It doesn't mean in any sense that they have a love for God. If someone needs a certain view of hell to be taught to them in order for them to get saved, then they don't seem to know what being saved means. Being saved is not just avoiding hell. Being saved is being bonded with Christ. And that's a very different thing. You know, so you're right. When people say, well, we have to have the most severe view of hell in our preaching, or else people won't get saved, I think, well, if they won't get saved without that, they probably aren't getting saved anyway. They're just making a deal. They're just making a deal for themselves. And that's not what Christianity calls people to do. Jesus said, if anyone come after me, let him deny himself and take up his cross and follow me. That's not dealing, that's not making a deal for your own advantage. That's denying yourself and just saying, it's going to be about God from now on, not me. And that's true no matter what hell turns out to be. In fact, it's true even if I'm going to go to hell anyway. Now, of course, that's not the case. I don't know anyone who believes that you'll go to hell anyway, even if you come to Christ. But what I'm saying is a person should be willing to come to Christ because of who he is. And should be willing to do so even if no such thing as hell existed. Well, there is a hell, and it's a place that no one's going to want to go to, but to have different views of what it is has no bearing whatsoever on people really being saved. Because the gospel preaching, as I know you've heard me say this before, Peter, but some listening maybe haven't, if you read the gospel as it was preached in the book of Acts by Peter in his gospel sermons and by Paul in his gospel sermons, they never mentioned hell or heaven in their sermons. They weren't preaching about the next life. They were preaching about Jesus. And what they were calling people to do is to repent of their rebellion against God and to be rejoined on good terms with God, which is what God created us for. They didn't mention hell or heaven because their message was not about what happens after you die. Their their message was about what you're called to do right now while you're not dead. And you can find out after you die what's over there. But, of course, the Bible does teach there's a heaven and a hell. But it simply wasn't featured in any of the preaching of the apostles in the book of Acts. And anyone can check me out on that who wants to.
No, thanks, Steve. Yeah, I've taken much time on here. So, no, have a good weekend, Steve, and God bless
good,
you. Thanks.
Good talking to you, brother. Call. All right, God bless. Bye now.
All right, God bless.
Good weekend. Michael from Denver, Colorado, welcome to the Narrow Path.
Hi, Steve. Thank you for taking my call. And I just had a quick question, then I'll take my answer over the air. Okay. And it's good to talk to you again as well. So I wanted to ask you about Samson, the story of Samson. You know, I was kind of thinking about this. You know, despite Samson's extreme strength that he was given, he had a lot of weaknesses. And, you know, I was thinking about this, how it could almost be interpreted as Samson not having the, you know, the emotional maturity almost to process some of the things he was faced with, because, you know, he became so consumed and with his own desires and revenge. And, you know, for example, when he sought revenge against the Philistines, and I was wanting to just kind of get your thoughts on that. Why do you think Samson took things so personally? Why do you think he, you know, interpreted them or, you know, took them so close to heart, so to speak?
Well, why was he so vengeful? It is true that he was vengeful. He was wronged by the Philistines, and he used that as an excuse to take it out on on them, sometimes to a much greater extent than the offense would justify. However, on the other hand, the Bible says that God allowed the Philistines to do this to him in order that he would have a occasion against them. So, I mean, Samson was, you know, he had a short fuse, and he cannot be commended for his good character. He didn't have very good character. But God, knowing that he was, you know, vengeful, actually orchestrated things where the Philistines would give him cause for offense. That's what it actually says. And so, remember, he was a judge, and the judges were, I mean, in the book of Judges, what the judges did is they led armies against their oppressors. In Samson's day, the Philistines were the oppressors. Now, instead of leading armies against them, Samson just took them on single-handedly, killing 1,000 at a time with almost his bare hands, and 3,000 at a time at the point of his death. So he was just like a superhero type who didn't need an army. He just needed a reason, you know, and so I, you know, he was not a particularly good man. Obviously, he had a vow. He didn't take it himself, though. His parents imposed the vow on him by the command of an angel. So it's obvious that God wanted him to keep that vow, and his parents put on. But he had never specifically agreed to that. The Nazirite vow that he had is something that most people took upon themselves voluntarily. And lots of people did. It's described in the 6th chapter of Numbers that anyone can take a Nazirite vow if they want to. But there are a few people in the Bible, like Samson and also Samuel and John the Baptist, who had Nazirite vows imposed upon them before they were born. And they were lifelong Nazirites because of the special calling God had on them, Samson being one of them. The difference between him and the other two being Samuel and John the Baptist, is that the other two actually had a heart for God. And it's not obvious whether Samson did or not. He had a vow, which he, of course, took rather lightly. He violated his vow numerous times, and ultimately, with the cutting off his hair, that was the last straw. That was the ultimate violation of the vow. So he was just a carnal man. He was kind of like a superhero in the eyes of the people, and heroes, you know, they can get the babes a lot of times, and he got the babes, and they were his downfall. But he compromised in other areas, too, touching the dead body of a lion, which, of course, Jews were not supposed to touch carcasses of unclean animals. You know, eating honey from one, that was definitely was unclean food for him. There's just various things he did wrong, including going to prostitutes. So what we have here is simply a man who was recruited in a sense, against his will and called into a ministry thing. Sort of like Jonah. Jonah was called to be a prophet against his will. He didn't want to be a prophet, and he tried to run away, and he never did have a right attitude about it, unlike probably most prophets. But, you know, sometimes God calls a man, and the man is resistant. And God even gives him gifts, spiritual gifts or whatever, superpowers, and the man still isn't, it doesn't have a heart for God. That was, I believe, Samson's problem. He just didn't have a heart for God. Now, he did believe in God, and it says in Hebrews chapter 11 that he did many great things by faith. He did know that there was a God, and he did know that, you know, God had given him powers, and he did these things by faith in God's powers. But, you know, there are people who have faith in God, but they're just not surrendered to God. I mean, they have faith in the sense they believe, but their belief does not change the direction of their life. And that was the case with Samson for the most part. And I've known a few people in my life, ministers, who could be described that way too. It's just a human characteristic to be carnal unless one has been converted. And I don't think that Samson was converted. All right, let's talk to Scotty in Las Vegas, Nevada. Scotty, welcome.
Hello.
Hello.
My question is about the ages of all of those in the Bible. For example, I was reading Genesis this morning, and we found out that Noah lived to a whopping age of 950 years. Now, my question is, first of all, how do these people live for so long, rather than only maybe 95 years? Second of all, if Noah lived that long, then surely it would make sense that he would have aged a lot less during his time. I was even thinking, could it be possible that Noah was a baby for about 20 years, then a teenager maybe for 180 years, and then an adult for maybe 500 years, and then an older man until he was 950 years. What do you think about that?
Well, I honestly don't know the answer to that. It seems to me that even if people would live a very long time, they would still reach adolescence and maturity probably the same as now, although I'm not sure. I don't know anybody who's lived that long, and we haven't any specimens to examine. It is possible that the entire aging process was slower. But I think, I don't know. I'm not inclined to think it would take, 20 years to get out of infancy, even if you're going to live to be 900. If you kind of divide up a lifetime into those different phases, proportional to the whole total, then you might come up with something like that. Or the alternative is to believe they grew to maturity at the same speed as anyone else does today, but they simply didn't become decrepit. They simply didn't get aged and old and infirm as quickly as we do. Now, as far as why, I don't know. Nobody really knows, but I suppose the main theory that's out there is that there were environmental factors before the flood. Some believe there was a vapor water canopy around the earth that shielded the earth from much of the radiation from space that decays and ages us. And therefore, people were shielded from that more before the flood. But when the flood happened, after that, people still lived quite long by today's standards, but only about half as long as the people before the flood. So we can see that there's like an immediate reduction in longevity right after the flood. Now, that doesn't tell us anything much, but it may suggest that there were environmental factors before the flood that ceased to exist afterward, and that would be why people before the flood lived almost twice as long as people lived immediately after the flood. Yeah, Noah lived to be 900 and something years old, but the next generation after him, it cut down very quickly, down to about 500 or less years. So there must have been something in the air, maybe something in the water, who knows? But anyway, that we can only conjecture.
Thank you.
All right. I appreciate your call. It's not a bad question. It's just one that we don't have any kind of authoritative answer given to us about. But God bless you, Scotty.
Thank you. God bless you.
All right. Bye now. Okay. I'm watching the clock here, and we have a hard break coming up every day at the bottom of the hour. The whole hour is commercial free, and we don't even have a commercial at the bottom of the hour, but we do have we have an information minute at the bottom of the hour to let you know that the Narrow Path has a website with lots of resources. They're all free, and the resources are mostly audio, but now there's a lot of written resources too, including my books are available there. Audio books of three of my books are there for free. You can listen to them. It's really got a wealth of resources. Over 1,500 lectures of mine, I believe, are there. That website is thenarrowpath.com. And just like this radio show, The Narrow Path is something that we don't do for commercial purposes, and it's listener supported. If you'd like to help us stay on the air, you can write to The Narrow Path, P.O. Box 1730, Temecula, California, 92593. Or just go to the website and donate from there if you want to. It's thenarrowpath.com. We have another half hour coming. I'll be back in 30 seconds. Don't go away.
Small is the gate and narrow is the path that leads to life. We're proud to welcome you to The Narrow Path with Steve Gregg. Steve has nothing to sell you today, but everything to give you. When today's radio show is over, we invite you to visit thenarrowpath.com, where you'll find topical audio teachings, blog articles, verse-by-verse teachings, and the archives of all the radio shows. Study, learn, and enjoy. We thank you for supporting the listener-supported Narrow Path with Steve Gregg.
Welcome back to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg, and we're live for another half hour, and we're taking your calls during that time. We have a couple of lines open. I'll make this announcement I already made at the beginning of the program, and that is tomorrow we have a couple of meetings in Southern California for those listening in those areas who might be interested. It's only once a month we have this, but we have a men's Bible study in the morning in Temecula at 8 o'clock tomorrow morning. And if you're a man and you can get there, you're welcome to join us. Now, you don't have to be a man to go to our other meeting. It's an open Bible study in Buena Park in Orange County, California. And that's in the evening at 6 o'clock. And I go through each time a book of the Bible, giving an introduction, a thorough introduction, and a thorough overview of the books. Tomorrow night, we're going through the short book of 2 Peter, and the book that's that shares so much in common with it, the book of Jude. And so that's tomorrow night. So feel free to join us if you happen to be local in the area. We'd be glad to see you there. We're going to talk next to Edward in Paradise Hills, California. Edward, welcome. Thanks for calling.
Yeah. Yes, thank you, Steve. I appreciate you answering. I have a question, and what it is based on somebody, Richard Dawkins, who has written a book called God is an Illusion. And my understanding is he says he's an atheist agnostic. But I just want to know, am I sinning by judging him in what he says, and I don't believe in what he says? So that's kind of what my question is.
Well, how could you be sinning by not believing in a lie? I would think it'd be more sinful to believe in a lie. Now, you seem to think it's wrong to judge, and maybe that's just because there's a false notion, very popular mostly among unbelievers, that Christians are not supposed to judge people. The Bible doesn't say we're not supposed to judge. It says we're not supposed to judge a certain way, but everyone makes judgments. Jesus said in Matthew 7:1, judge not that you be not judged. But he goes on to say what he means is, if you're judging somebody who has a problem that's analogous to having a speck in your eye, but you yourself have the problem in spades, like you have a beam in your eye, then you're hypocritical if you judge a person like that because you've got the problem worse than they do. But then Jesus says, get him out of your own eye, then you will see clearly to take the speck out of your brother's eye. In other words, there's nothing wrong with correcting your brother and finding fault and helping him remove it from his life, if as long as you're not being a hypocrite and you know secretly doing the same things that he's doing. So Jesus is just forbidding a hypocritical judgment. But in another place in John 7, I think it's John 7, 24, if I'm not mistaken, Jesus said, do not judge according to appearance, but judge righteous judgment. So we're just as we're told not to judge some ways, we are told to judge another way. So when you read Richard Dawkins, by the way, his book is called The God Delusion. He's written many books, but that's the one that probably got the most attention in recent times. And I've read it. But you say, are you wrong to judge that he's wrong? Of course not. I mean, the Bible says, test all things and hold fast to what is good. You know, Richard Dawkins himself says that people should do that. He's just not very wise to make that recommendation. In his book, The Devil's Chaplain, Dawkins said this, quote, he said, if the next time someone tells you that such a thing is true, ask him, what evidence do you have for that? And if he doesn't have good evidence, I would recommend you don't believe him. That's what Dawkins said. And I think that is very excellent advice. If somebody, including Dawkins, tells you that something is true, ask him what evidence there is. Now, Dawkins is a very famous and accomplished and I would say competent biologist. He's one of England's most famous and leading biological experts. But being an expert in biology doesn't really make you have any information about whether there's a God or not, any more than being a Mercedes mechanic, a five-star mechanic, makes you have any information about whether, Papua New Guinea exists as a country. I mean, simply different kinds of questions. You can be an expert about how to fix cars and know nothing about world geography. You can know a great deal about how an organism works and know nothing about whether there's a God or not. It's not in the same category. So, Dawkins wrote his book, The God Delusion, resting on the laurels of the fact that he was already a best-selling author and one of the most respected biologists in England. But being a respected biologist, you could be the smartest biologist in the whole world and not have even begun to know anything about whether there's a God or not. It's not, God isn't biological. Now, when speaking about biology, Dawkins is an expert. When talking about any other subject, he's a layman. Just like I can talk about biology, but I'll be a layman. I'm not an expert on biology, but I know some things about it. But if I were to write a book on biology, I don't think Dawkins would think he had any reason to have to read it. Why would he read my book on biology? And if he's going to write a book about God, I don't know why I should read it. I did, because I want to know what people are reading from him, but I don't know why anyone should take him seriously on it. Are you sinning by not believing him? No, I think it'd be more sinful to believe it. If you believed it, it would either be because you're innocently intellectually deficient, if you believed what he said, or maybe you're smart and you just are buying it because you have some motives other than interest in truth. Dawkins, by the way, did not provide evidence in his book that there is no God. And that's a violation of his own rule. If someone tells you something, ask them what evidence is there. If they can't tell you anything good, don't believe them. That's what he says. Well, he tells us there's no God. What evidence is there that there's no God? Absolutely none. There's no evidence that there's no God. What we do find evidence for in Dawkins' work and in that of his fellow atheists who wrote similar books around the same time, Christopher Hitchens and Daniel Dennett and Sam Harris, they all wrote atheist books around the same time, around the 2006-ish. What they do provide evidence for is that they don't like God. They don't like God, and they don't like people who believe in God. Now, they give lots of evidence of that. But that's a very different thing than saying they have provided evidence that there is no God, to say you don't like something is not even making the first step toward proving that the thing you don't like is non-existent. I never liked Hitler. I didn't live at the time, but from what I know of him, I don't like him, and I wouldn't have liked him if I was around when he's alive. But that wouldn't prove he didn't exist. Many unpleasant things, from our point of view, do exist. Cancer, for example. Many people listening to me probably have been told that they have cancer. I doubt that they like that. But that doesn't mean that the cancer doesn't exist. Lots of things unpleasant to us do exist. And what Dawkins has proven is that the idea of God is very unpleasant to him. And that's as far as he can go in proving anything, which, of course, proves nothing of value. So, yeah, you do well, actually, not to believe him. And so, no, it's not a sin
for putting
to
me
disbelieve.
At peace.
All right. God bless you.
Thank you so much for putting me at peace. Thank you.
All right. Bye now. Okay, let's talk to Austin in Grand Blanc, Michigan. Hi, Austin. Welcome.
Hey, Steve. Thank you for having me on.
Uh-huh.
My family, we've been looking into the house church. It's, you know, kind of a common thing now. People are doing house church. We've looked around churches in our area and haven't been able to find any that either aren't Calvinists or are, you know, doing, I would say, edification or having models mm-hmm. of something like a small group, and we're craving edification. We're craving spiritual growth. And so I came across Dr. Tom Wadsworth. I don't know if you've heard of him.
No.
He's a really interesting guy. He spent a lot of time with his PhD doing research on early church worship, and specifically uh-huh. that English word worship and kind of where we get those ideas. And he did a whole series on YouTube that's available, 7 parts, and then he has one video that condenses all the 7 parts into one shorter video. And we found it really interesting because he's emphasizing that idea of edification, that all things in the church that we do should be done for the edification of the saints. And we've felt that lacking from the kind of traditional, conventional churches that we've been a part of. Not that, you know, we love the people there, but we find that one pastor delivering didactic preaching, while it is helpful and at times edifying, we find that there's often not enough of the, you know, equipping the saints for the working of the ministry, but instead we're kind of just being, we're given a sermon and then we walk out the door at the end. And it's a bit of a grief that we feel, you know, we want to connect with believers.
I hear
you. So I was curious to hear your thoughts.
Well, I have the exact same thoughts, and that is that the modern churches, first of all, they conduct themselves very differently than the early church did. If you read 1 Corinthians, you can see something about how the early church conducted itself. Justin Martyr in the 2nd century also gave sort of a summary of how the churches conducted themselves. Quite a few of the books of the Bible, as well as church fathers, have said that the early church had what they called an agape feast. And it seems like much of their worship was actually done at a fellowship meal. I mean, it's very different than most churches today. Now, I don't say that a church has to do things today precisely as they did in the early church, because there might be some things the early church did that ministered to the people in their actual spiritual and physical needs, which we'd have to modify a little bit to accomplish the same thing in a different kind of a world. But it seems like we should have the same goals as the early church had. And the goals of the early church were to be a loving community obedient to Jesus Christ and to worship God with a pure heart in spirit and in truth. And for their whole life, for Christians' whole lives to be a worship, as Paul said, that you yield your body, present your body as a living sacrifice, which is your spiritual worship in Romans 12:1. So, you know, the ideas of simply going to a meeting, sitting in theater seating, watching a presentation from a platform ahead of you, much of which contains entertainment rather than edification. And even those that are edifying, often, many times people, preachers, they stick with the Bible pretty good, but they stick with favorite topics in the Bible so that you don't really get taught all the things that are the priorities for Christians to learn. Remember what Jesus said, go and make disciples and teach them to observe everything I have commanded you in Matthew 28:20. So the church should be teaching people to observe everything Jesus commanded. In many cases, if the church is using the Bible at all in their sermons, it's to reinforce certain doctrines of a particular denominational group. And that's a very different thing than teaching people to be obedient to Christ in everything he commanded. It's very, very hard these days, and maybe it has been for years, to find a church that has the same interests that an early church had, or that conducts itself on the same principles as the early church. So a lot of people are moving toward what they might call organic church models, or, of course, house church, home church. Some people actually meet in parks. Some people meet in, restaurants. But I think the most common organic church venue would be a home church. Now, this is definitely going back to the early practice of the church, because we read in the book of Acts that all, or not just that, but the Acts and the epistles, that most of the churches met in the homes of someone who was a member of the church. And what they did there can be explored by studying the epistles, and also from what, like I said, what Justin Martyr said and so forth. But the main thing is that meeting in a home is much more in keeping with, New Testament patterns than having a building called a church. They didn't have those in the first century. Now, some people might think we're better off having them because we have much bigger meetings. Well, if the idea is having a theater, then yeah, a big theater is probably makes more money than a little theater. But in my opinion, the church's meetings are not for the sake of theater, and they're not to be performative, and they're not to be for the sake of making money. In fact, in my opinion, everybody who serves in the church in any way should do so as a volunteer. Anyone who thinks that godliness is a means of gain, Paul said, is someone to be avoided. So, in other words, we've drifted very, very far from the whole idea of church. Now, I'm not saying that every house church fully remedies these problems, because in many cases people say, I don't like any of the churches around here, so we're going to start meeting in a church with a few friends. And what they do is the same kind of thing in their home that was being done in the church. It's just smaller. And while that might be more intimate and enjoyable, maybe even beneficial, it's not necessarily a radical change. It can be. But let me just recommend to you something. I have a series of lectures at our website called Some Assembly Required. This is an exploration of how the early church conducted itself in contrast to the way it developed into the church that we now see almost any place you go to church. And it's an analysis of the way that the early church differed in their meetings and their conduct and their goals than most modern churches do. It's more than just meeting in a home. Although, many, many Christians are now meeting in homes. In fact, the church I attend is in a home also. I'm part of a home church. But many people can meet in homes without having really much of a better church experience than they might have in a bigger church. It doesn't matter how big it is, although I would say smaller, all other things being equal, provides a better opportunity to get to know everybody. If you're in a big church with thousands of people, you probably won't get to know more than a handful of people after going there for years. Whereas if you're going to a house church that has 12 to 20 people, or 25 or 30, maybe maximum, you'll probably get to know everyone pretty well. And you'll be able to have actual fellowship, and over the period of years, they'll be close friends, and you'll be able to share in each other's lives and bear each other's burdens and pray for each other and counsel each other, maybe help each other financially. This is how the church operated in the early church. And it's much more easy to do that in a smaller church. But I just recommend that you go to my website, thenarrowpath.com. And there's a tab there that says topical lectures, and there's a series called Some Assembly Required. And it's about the early church, and it suggests ways we can get back to doing things in a more biblical way.
Awesome. Thank you for that, Steve. And when do you think you'll be, you said you were coming into Michigan in August, right?
Yes. I don't know exactly the dates or the parts. Where am I going to be?
Okay.
August 30th?
I'll keep an eye out.
Near Grand Rapids. Okay. I'll be in Grand Rapids area around August 30th, but I'm willing to be anywhere in Michigan or in the general area, northern Illinois, Indiana. When I go someplace to speak, I'm always willing to extend my visit to the area for, to a week and speak every day somewhere. And I'll drive all over the place to get there.
Very cool. Well, thank you, Steve. I really appreciate it.
Okay, Austin. God bless you.
Yep, you too.
Thanks for calling. Yeah. Okay, let's see here. Our next caller is Danny from New York, New York. Hi, Danny. Welcome to The Narrow Path.
Hey, Steve. How are you? It's Danny.
Good.
Yeah, Steve, listen, my dad, I want to talk to you. I want to ask you today. I want to say my dad. He's he's being very, very, very critical towards me, and it's like, he shows no respect, no dignity, nothing. He shows no remorse for his wrong actions. And also my wife, who it was an arranged marriage. It was an arranged marriage back in India a few years ago, mm-hmm. 5 years ago. Mm-hmm. And she also joins him, and she like teams up with him, and they're like, they're not good to me and to my mom, but they're really giving me mental anguish, So my question is, how can I get rid of that? How can I make him understand, because he doesn't get it, and she's also joining him, my wife, and
could you
really
tell me
uncomfortable.
Could you tell me what it is he doesn't get? Is it that, are you a Christian and he's not? Is that the issue?
Yeah, he's Punjabi. He's from India.
Uh-huh.
Punjabi. And I'm a born again, I believe. And he doesn't consider that I'm a Christian and my good works, my good actions. He doesn't value any of that. So my question is, why is he like that? And what can make him change? Because nothing can make him change.
All right, I hear you. And I'm not sure there's anything you can do to make him change, although that doesn't mean he won't change. First of all, I'm very sorry for you to be in that circumstance. It must be very heartbreaking to feel rejected by your father. David, in the Bible, he wrote Psalm 27. And in verse 10, he said, "When my father and my mother forsake me, then the Lord will take care of me." In other words, David said, even if my parents reject me, and I have reason to believe that they might have. There are some things in David's life and his dynamics in his family that make me wonder, maybe his parents did reject him. But he says, even if that happens, I've got God. God is a father to the fatherless. And so if you're faithful to God, God is faithful to you and respects you. It's nice to have the respect of our parents, or frankly, the respect of people at all. If you feel like no one respects you, I guess you can go on, the stand-up comedy circuit like Rodney Dangerfield and say nobody, I get no respect. But it's not a funny thing to feel like you don't get any respect. But all we really need is God's respect. Jesus rebuked the Pharisees in John chapter 5. He said, "How can you believe who receive honor from each other and don't seek the honor that comes from God alone?" It's hard for us to forget, that people reject us and to put that out of our minds. But if God is real to us, then of course that we realize that, there's coming a time when you'll stand before God, and so will everybody else And God will respect you. God will honor you because you honored him. And others who don't honor you now won't. But I realize it's not much comfort to think of your father or your wife standing before God and not experiencing honor from you, because I would imagine you want them to have God's approval too. It's hurtful to think of them not knowing God. But why are they that way? It's because they're not Christians. How can you change them? Well, you probably can't, but there are things you should do whether it'll change them or not. You should love them. You should love them unconditionally. You should be kind to them. You should mention Christ to them as often as they will tolerate it. And you should demonstrate with your life that you are a better person than you would have been because you're a follower of Christ. If you talk about Jesus, but they look at your life and say, I'm not impressed. I'm not impressed that Jesus has done anything for you. I want done for me. Well, then no one's going to want to listen to you. But if your life is serving the Lord, if you're humble and meek and gentle and honest, and you don't lose your temper, and you're generous and you're kind and you love people who persecute you, well, what you're doing there is not just telling them about Jesus, you're showing them Jesus. And a picture is worth a thousand words, by the way. You know, Peter in 1 Peter 3 wrote to wives who were Christians, and they were married to husbands who were not. And he told them that they could possibly win their husband without a word by simply exhibiting a Christian spirit in the home. Now, he didn't guarantee that they'd be won that way, but that's what he recommended in order to win them. If you want to win your wife, if you want to win your father, I think the best you can do is to be as much like Jesus as possible. He may not like it, especially if he doesn't like Jesus. If someone doesn't like Jesus, then the more like Jesus you are, the less they'll probably like you, because they'll see in you the things they don't like in him. But on the other hand, the fact that they don't like it might mean, and in many cases does mean, that they're feeling convicted. You know, they hate the person who makes them feel guilty, not because you're telling him he's guilty, but because your submission to Christ and your righteous life is such a contrast to his own that, you know, the guilt he feels might very well, make him hate you because you make him feel that way. But you should make sure that you're not doing anything to make him feel that way. You should be loving and gracious to him. But let the Holy Spirit convict him. And obviously pray for him. Pray for him. Pray for your wife. Be an example of what a Christian is supposed to be. Speak about Christ insofar as that's something they allow you to do. If they won't listen, if they get angry when you speak about Christ, then you don't have to speak about him all the time. You can speak with your actions. But, I mean, nothing you do will 100% guarantee that they will change their opinion. But the things I'm suggesting, I think, are the very best way to pursue getting them to change their opinion. Whether that'll happen or not has a lot to do with how God deals with them. But we can certainly demonstrate the love of Christ and speak the love of Christ when they're receptive. And then, just leave it in God's hands. And if they never change, if you're rejected permanently by your parents and your wife, God forbid, but if that happens, just know that God's approval is worth a whole lot more than that of any man or woman. You might benefit, if you wish, to listen to some lectures of mine at my website at thenarrowpath.com. There's a series called Making Sense Out of Suffering. It's only 4 lectures, so it doesn't take too long to listen to it, but Making Sense Out of Suffering, I'd recommend. All the lectures are free. You just go there and listen to them. That's at thenarrowpath.com. I'm sorry to hear about the problem in your relationship with your family, but Jesus was misunderstood by his brothers, and he was misunderstood by his parents, and so forth. So I guess it's about average for that to happen. Sorry. You've been listening to The Narrow Path. I'm out of time. Our website is thenarrowpath.com. Thanks for joining us. God bless.